So I'm very pleased to introduce the last speaker, Richard Fisher. Richard was a student of chemistry at the University of Bristol, and then went on to do medicine and practiced many years as a GP. And he's rediscovered life as a medievalist, actually also in the crossing into the early modern period, writing a PhD supervised by Beth Williamson and James Clark. So quite interdisciplinary too, an art historian and a medievalist. And his paper today is Three Choirs and the Reformation, Refashioning History of Hereford, Worcester and Gloucester Cathedrals. Over to you, Richard.
Thanks very much. I thought I'd talk in two parts this morning, hopefully 10 minutes, just to sum up my PhD work and try and give you a bit of a clue as to why it has some relevance for the Borders and Borderlands work that today is all about. And then the second part is to look at one particular cathedral that I study and some aspects about how it came about. So just very briefly to talk about the PhD, if you think about two subjects, cathedrals and Reformation, you think they might have been done to death, really. But the interaction, the overlap of these two subjects are surprisingly under-researched. And I think I'm now, after doing this part-time for 6 years, have a better understanding of why. Because they're complicated, but in very different ways. And the narratives that have grown up to try and explain them don't easily overlap with each other. And hopefully my work's shed some light on that. I don't know if you know much about the medieval cathedrals of England, but there were 19 cathedrals and only 17 dioceses, which is something of a curiosity to start with. For a country of its size, England didn't have very many cathedrals. You think of Italy or France, every medium-sized town you go to has got a cathedral, and they have hundreds and hundreds of things. And partly because of the very long-term stable relationship between crown and state and church in England, we ended up with this number of 17 dioceses around about 1130, and it didn't change for the hundreds of years up to the time of Henry VIII. And the other strangeness about the cathedrals and the dioceses of England is that the cathedrals were divided roughly 50% each into two very contrasting ways of running them, half of which are called secular cathedrals and the other half are monastic cathedrals, and they have very, very differing types of administration. So here's the map of the medieval diocese of England with the cathedrals marked with the crosses, and you'll soon work out that the reason why we ended up with 19 cathedrals and only 17 dioceses. There's two of the dioceses, Bath and Wells, which you've kind of probably heard of, and perhaps less familiar, Coventry and Lichfield, had two cathedrals, but only one bishop. And they each had one of the type, one secular and one monastic type. As you can see, some of the dioceses are enormous. York and Lincoln runs all the way from the River Humber right down to the River Thames. It's a kind of a monstrous scale, I think. And Henry VIII, after around 1540, finally decides to create six new ones. And interestingly, it's very interesting, you come to a thing like today, and so many themes kind of crop up time and time again. The big diocese of Lincoln got chopped into thirds with new cathedrals at Peterborough and Oxford. The northwest of England gets a diocese at Chester, the Romans kind of finally exerting their power again in the northwest of England. So the northwest of England gets a cathedral. The city of Bristol doesn't have a cathedral until after 1540. It's got St. Mary Redcliffe and it's got this great big abbey of Augustinian canons at the bottom of Park Street. But it's only after 1540 that the city finally gets a cathedral for itself. Probably because by this time it's probably the second city of the nation. In a very strange fashion, its diocese was carved out of Dorset, which is sort of down here. So you've got the little island of the city of Bristol, and all the rest of the diocese that the bishop has to run is down here, which is a very strange way of doing it. But Dorset was about the only place that anyone was willing to give up, to give to the bishop. Westminster Abbey for a period of time, for about 10 years, becomes a cathedral. So there was a bishop of Westminster, but only one. And the sixth one is the Cathedral of Gloucester. And so the three that make up the ones that I'm interested in are Worcester as a monastic example, run by Benedictine monks, Hereford as a secular example, and Gloucester, which wasn't a cathedral until 1540. It was just a Benedictine abbey. And they're only 25 miles apart, and they form this strange kind of Bermuda Triangle in the far west of England, away from all the political goings on in London and the southeast. And you think cathedrals and the Reformation, they might become a bit more alike. And the thing I find is they become even more unlike. So Hereford, as I say, is a secular cathedral. It's run by a dean, and he has three assistants, senior men, called the precentor, the treasurer, and the chancellor, the quattuor personae, and then a group of canons who are funded by a system of prebendaries. So this time, a canon and a prebendary are pretty much the same thing in a secular cathedral. The prebend is a parish that generates the income that funds the canon, and the dean and the canons make up the chapter. The reason why Hereford is interesting, and from a borders point of view, is that it's remote. It's really, in many ways, really in Wales. If you put all the cathedrals in terms of their income, Hereford's right down the bottom. It's very poor, so poor and remote. And it, interestingly, doesn't take on the Reformation. Wherever possible, it just pretends it's not happening. And as a consequence, when it comes to the reign of Queen Mary and England reverts back to Catholicism, it's no big deal for Hereford to switch back to its old ways. And it does this partly because of a very kind of tight-knit community where the dean and the chapter and the cathedral and the local citizens in the city and the small number of parishes that it contains are very close-knit and very loyal to each other. And as a consequence, it becomes a bit of a magnet for Catholic sympathisers at this period. Worcester, as I said, was a monastic cathedral. So it's strictly called a cathedral priory. Monastic cathedrals arose in England before the conquest, when very often the abbot was a monk, became the bishop. So you had a man who's the bishop and an abbot, and he has to go off running his diocese, so he leaves it to the second in command, who is called the prior. So monastic cathedrals are monastic cathedral priories, and they're run by a prior who acts as if he's the abbot and a chapter of monks. 70 in Durham, around about 40 in Worcester. And one of the second to last prior of Worcester is a chap called William Moore, whose journal, so-called, really is a kind of list of his expenditures, survives in is been translated and transcribed and gives great detail about the life of this individual who in the end really exhibits all those failings that the traditional narrative of the Reformation associates with monks, of being lazy, of going off hunting, of having manners out in the countryside, and sadly neglecting the monks back at the cathedral priory. Their dormitory roof falls in, and they gradually get more and more disgruntled by him. And as the Reformation is proceeding, they oust Prior Moore, and he's replaced by the last prior, who's an evangelical. And then they get two bishops, Bishop Latimer and Hooper, who you might have heard of in the story of the Reformation, who come to unfortunate sticky ends under Mary. And so the cathedral is invaded by evangelical outsiders and is turned into a bit of a showcase of how to do the Reformation. And so this is the place where the buildings drastically altered, the whitewash and the altars were all stripped out. And the laity of the city of Worcester gradually become more and more disinterested in their cathedral, and they stop leaving it any money in their wills, whereas the ones back in their secular Hereford keep piling in the money much as they ever had done. And so the third place is Gloucester, a newly founded ex-abbey. As I say, it wasn't a cathedral until 1640. And Gloucester as an abbey didn't really get on particularly well with its citizens in the town of Gloucester before it got elevated to city status, because it really didn't have any need to. It was extremely well off. He owned a large proportion of the city properties, many of which it had turned into hotels, a bit like a kind of monopoly game, because, as you'll find out when I talk about the second part, really, is why that all came around. And so the cathedral then starts off with bad relationships with its locals, and somehow it gets turned into a cathedral, and then it has to turn this relationship around. It can't carry on being a cathedral and not get on with the people of its diocese. And a lot of this I put down to changes that happened to the building. So I've divided my thesis up into chapters on personnel, administration, and finance, sort of the who, really. How the cathedrals fitted into their cities, so the place of their precincts and the buildings in the precincts and how that interacts with the surroundings. I look at the church building in the cathedrals and its contents and how that changed as the Reformation went along. What was it the cathedral did, its mainly spiritual functions and how its liturgy and music changed over the period. And an important chunk, I think, that demonstrates the Reformation in action is how the cathedral got on with its laity or not. And looking at the people, one of the large chunks of evidence that survives are in their wills. Hundreds and hundreds of wills survive from this period. They're a very kind of dodgy source in many ways, because if you think about, I don't know how many of you have written your will already, but you're sort of giving instructions for something that you don't particularly want to necessarily look forward to in the future and hope that might get carried out when you're not there. So it's an odd kind of piece of evidence in a way. But for the period that I look at, and I've taken them from 1529 to 1559, a 30-year period from before the church in England had any notions of being reformed, when it was still definitely run by Catholic Church in Rome, and until the end of Mary's period, so it's kind of from Catholicism out of it and really back into Catholicism again, I come up with roughly 400 wills which I've transcribed and taken the information out of them to try and work out what these people thought about what might happen to them after their death and what this can tell you about their attitude towards their cathedral in particular. But lots of other bits of useful information come up at the same time. In this late medieval period, and continuing on during the Reformation, and in fact until the early 19th century, the mechanism for deciding what was the kind of outcome of a will was decided either by a diocesan consistory court, and it's, like I say, it still happened until the early 19th century, or if your will was worth large amounts of money, or covered two dioceses, or covered the provinces of York and Canterbury, then the prerogative court of Canterbury, a court set up by under the kind of auspices of the Archbishop of Canterbury, examined and proved your will. So all the kind of well-off, the people with lots of money or properties in spread around large numbers of places, would have their wills looked at by the prerogative court of Canterbury. The sort of less well-off would have them looked at by the local diocese. So if you had more than £100 worth of value in your will, it would go to the prerogative court of Canterbury and they would charge a kind of premium for proving it. And the good thing about the prerogative court of Canterbury is that their records survive in a nice kind of easy read, I'd say, structure, at least they're kind of reasonably easy to read. And wills have a structure which hasn't really changed much. So if you go off to a lawyer now, he will say to you, well, do you want to put anything vaguely religious in? What do you hope to happen to your kind of spiritual remains? Where do you want your physical remains to go? What do you want doing on the day that they're disposed of? And then the bit everybody's interested in, all the kind of the goods and the properties. And the reason why it's called a will and a testament is that the will bit relates to the landed property, strictly, and the testament relates to all what we would now call movable property, so all the bits you could pick up and take away, strictly speaking. And so if we look at Sir John Price, who is the person that Helen Fulton latched onto my having. He just came up as a name in my 400, just purely by chance. His will was taken to the prerogative court of Canterbury and then rewritten out in this nice, closely written, but at least kind of reasonably clear fashion. And so that's the reason why I suppose I'm here today. And he wrote it in October 1555, and it was proved in January the following year, so presumably written reasonably close to his time of death. And I'm just going to read you a few little bits. I don't know if any of you here are interested in John Price or know much about him. I don't know if you've seen his will before. But as it says here, let me put our name, I, John Price of Hereford in the county of Herefordshire, it would be. And I won't come on pointing it out like that. But it says, Knight, being sick in body, nevertheless whole in mind, do make my last will and testament in manner and form following. First, I bequeath my soul to Almighty God, our Blessed Lady St. Mary, and to all the blessed company of heaven. Well, that's a kind of classic Catholic preamble from a man who went round shutting monasteries and in the end bought one, St. Guthlac's Priory in Hereford, to live in. So, and this is at the time of Queen Mary. So he kind of started off with a very standard Catholic God, Mary, and all the saints preamble. And my body to be buried in the Cathedral Church of Hereford if I die in Hereford, or else in some other Christian burial where my executors or administrators shall think most convenient. And I will, a stone with an inscription by the device of some of my executors or administrators, be set on my tomb within 1 year after my decease, mentioning the day and time of my decease, and request of all men's prayers. Well, he's clearly latching back on to the doctrine of purgatory, which the evangelicals in the Reformation have done so much to try and to get rid of. So he's now asking for people to pray for his soul in order for him to kind of get out of purgatory quicker. And I will a fair black stone, which I left at Pershaw, Worcestershire, be set hither for that purpose. My friend Master Martin, the curate of Pershaw aforesaid, doth know where the stone remaineth. And as touching the device and order of my goods, blah, 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 and he goes. And there's page after page of all this stuff, talking about all sorts of property. One really interesting bit that I like is that he gets his three executors to each hold a key to a chest in which he's put 1,000 marks, which is like a vast sum of money to me, in order to pay for the weddings of his three daughters. And all these three executives have got to turn up on the same day and open the box to release the money. But he also says, item, I give and bequeath to be bestowed in arms at Hereford by the discretion of the mayor and two of the eldest eldermen amongst poor householders and poor maidens' marriages, £20. So he's going back to a very kind of old practice of giving money to the poor directly, supervised by somebody else, and particularly a very old practice of giving money to maidens' marriages. Perhaps of more interest to you here that's interested in his books, he says, I to my give and bequeath to the Cathedral Church of Hereford to be put in their library all my written books of divinity. I give to my sons, Gregory and Richard, all my printed books, saving the works of St. Augustine and the course on the canon law, which I give to the foremaster, Master Smith, Vicar of Bromgard, to be divided between them by the discretion of my executor. Item, I bequeath to my son Richard all my written books of history and humanity. And this is kind of what he's kind of famous for, as being this humanist who gets dragged into the civil service all against his will, really. And part of the project, as I understand it, is trying to itemize his books and his writings, where they've gone, and kind of why he collected the things he did. Item, I will that my son Richard should put my books in print that I have made against Polydore's story of England. Him and Polydore Virgil didn't get on, didn't see eye to eye, and certainly he didn't agree with Polydore's version of the history of England. And to annex to the same piece, some piece of antiquity that is not yet printed out of the written books of history that I have in my house. So he kind of written this diatribe against Polydore, and he hadn't managed to get it printed by this stage, and he wanted his son, after his death, to get this done, and I think about 15 years later it does come into print. Item, I give my Welsh books to Thomas Vaughan of Glamorganshire. He's big into Welsh, of course, being a Welshman himself. And he's, I don't know much about Welsh books, but I think he's engaged in the earliest translations of part of the Bible into Welsh and various bits of Welsh liturgy. You'll be able to tell me more about that, I hope. And the final thing that he does, and you can see there's an awful lot of pages of stuff and property that he's giving away. Near the end, he says, item, I will that my executors shall deliver and distribute to churches within the county of Hereford all such church apparel as I had within this county, if any remaineth in my house undistributed. And what he basically means by that, I think, is that at the time of the Reformation, he went round pinching people's vestments and church altar coverings to make into nice things to have in his house. And if there are any of them left, now that Mary's back in charge, Catholicism is back in favour, he feels that the churches that he got these textile items from should have them back. And there's similar corroborating evidence from a chap called Machin, who was a diarist in London, who tells how Queen Mary tries to redistribute as many of the vestments that end up being held in the Tower of London at Westminster Abbey as she can find original owners for. So that's the will of Sir John Price, who clearly is a borderlands man himself. And that's the sort of evidence that, like I say, I actually fought 399 others of these to look at. So the... Oh no, that's the first one, isn't it? Sorry. Where's the other one? So the other thing I just want to talk about this morning is a piece of literature which is way outside of my area of expertise. So I thought I'd start with a bit of an apology, as I come here as a bit of a fraud, mainly that I should confess that I am no scholar of English literature, and yet will be discussing a sort of poem. In my defence, I propose to talk about aspects of Gloucester Abbey, which Professor Fulton assured me is a border location, which harks back to its foundation and the medieval patronage that bear on the reasons why it wasn't demolished in 1540, which I promise is the latest date I will try and mention. What I intend to discuss falls into three sections. Firstly, I'll describe a bit about medieval tabulae, and in particular, the tabulae of William Malvern, who was the last abbot of Gloucester before it was suppressed. And then I'll describe the relevance of this to the transformation of the Romanesque abbey building by the refashioning of its eastern end in the innovative style of Perpendicular Gothic in the 14th century. And then finally, I'll explain how this and some other efforts of Abbot Malvern contributed to the survival of the abbey as a refounded Tudor cathedral. William Malvern was elected abbot of the large and wealthy Benedictine convent of St. Peter's, Gloucester, in 1514 at the age of 30. He'd been to Oxford, he was a Doctor of Divinity, and had been appointed Master of Works at the Abbey, responsible for the upkeep of its buildings, prior to his almost unanimous election, in that he politely didn't vote for himself. This is in great contrast to his predecessor, whose election in 1510, 4 years earlier, had caused a great uproar, arousing admonition from Henry VIII, who had come to the throne the year before. And at that time, the abbey and the townsmen, as I mentioned, were having regular violent riots, on this particular occasion concerning grazing land across the River Severn, which also incurred Henry's wrath. So he'd upset them about their monastic elections, and he'd upset them because they were having... The public were having kind of pitched battles, going digging up the abbot's land, and then going sitting at the town cross with a big barrel of beer and saying, aren't we clever, we've managed to keep the abbot's cows across the other side of the river. This goes on for one summer in kind of typical summer riot fashion, just the year before Malvern comes into being the abbot. So Malvern comes to the post of superior with several urgent requirements to fulfil, to restore discipline to the Abbey, to improve its image and relationships with the public, and to convince the king that St. Peter's was still a loyal, worthy foundation. And I think he had an uphill struggle to start with. And as part of this campaign, he wrote a poem of 22 stanzas in rhyme royal, the verse form of Chaucer, and the abbot's contemporary, Sir Thomas Wyatt, so he's kind of choosing a good style, detailing the foundation history of the abbot with its significant royal connections both before and after the conquest. It was written in English and put in the nave for public edification, somewhat like a tourist information board. We know this because John Leyland, the Tudor's mobile librarian, as I like to think of him, came to Gloucester in 1539 and recorded, and quote, things exerted out of certain writings on the wall of the north aisle in the body of the Cathedral Church of Gloucester, end quote, which he preceded in his itinerary. The original tabulae are now lost, but a 17th century copy survives in the collections of Gonville and Caius College, Cambridge, and it's this version that I'm presenting here. But before we get to the text, I would just like to explain briefly a little about medieval tabulae, of which I think Malvern's example could have been amongst the last made before the monastic suppression. Very few originals survive, a couple in York, and probably the most famous from 14th century Glastonbury Abbey is now in the Bodleian, and there it is. It has an oak frame, hinged to open like a book, with two more wooden boards inside, giving six surfaces for writing. When open, it's 107 centimetres wide and 112 centimetres high, so it's a big thing. The parchment sheets are stuck on the boards, and it has holes in the top and bottom to hang it up with nails. This one contains the foundation history of Glastonbury, along with stories of its connection with Arthur and Guinevere, Joseph Arimathea, plus a list of the relics, shrines and indulgences available to view and enjoy on site. So it's clearly kind of written really in a style for people that are coming to visit the place. There are numerous references to such tables across the Middle Ages and later medieval period. One scholar, Michael van Dusen, has suggested that lots of the manuscripts we read as original tourist descriptions of famous places, he cites St. Paul's in London and St. George's Chapel at Windsor, are in fact direct copies from their non-surviving former tabulae. We've lost the tabulae, but we've kept the copies. So now on to Malvern's 16th century version at Gloucester. I won't subject you to all 22 verses, but to get the idea, here's the first one, and I apologise for my reading. In sundry fair volumes of antiquity, plain to set by evident relation, that first founded this noble monastery, the year of our Lord, 601, in the time of King Ethelred, by devotion of Osric, under king and chief lord of this shire, which after, as we read, was king of Northumbria. He recalls the foundation of St. Peter's in 681 by Osric, a minor prince of the West Midlands Hawicki tribe, but ever after conflated at Gloucester with an Osric of the same name, whose kingship of Northumberland bolstered the abbey's royal foundation legend. The first 12 verses give accounts of the royal benefactors who enriched the abbey in its first 500 years, but for our purposes, the key passage is in the 15th verse, where the narrative has moved on to the 14th century. Edward also, the second, most honoured king, whose body lieth here in this church, so angelic, or is that angel-like, was he, and ghostly in living, that God for his love many miracles did work, by whose oblation the south aisle of this church edified was and built, and also the choir, with many more good disease. Good deeds not rehearsed here. Now, the arrival of the king's body at St. Peter's Abbey changed everything. It also set in train many mythologies about him and the building. Now, our understanding of the death in disgrace of Edward II at Berkeley Castle in 1327 is likely to be accompanied with connotations not very angel-like or angelic, or ghostly in living, ghostly meaning holy. And the legend of the monks at Gloucester taking him in when the convents at Malmesbury and Bristol had refused have subsequently been shown to be false, with the crown funding his lavish coffin and carriage to St. Peter's. But the greatest mystery associated with Edward's location at Gloucester Abbey was the miraculous arrival of countless pilgrims to the site of his magnificent tomb to view his final resting place. St. Peter's was unusual amongst big abbeys in not having any major saint or shrine associated with the institution, but the flocks of the faithful were able to approach an anointed king here, and their subsequent donations to the abbey meant he was a perfectly satisfactory substitute. His tomb chest was even fitted with prayer niches. There were six of them. Just like those of the same shrine. Indeed, Richard II, a great admirer of Edward, tried to secure his canonization towards the end of the century. But if we look again at the verse on the tabula, just who was it that subsequently paid for the transformation of the Norman building? As I said, so angelic was he and ghostly in living that God for his love many miracles did work, by whose oblation the south aisle of this church edified was and built and also the choir. Who does this whose refer to? Was it the miracles caused by the dead king, or God, or the pilgriming public, or even the monks? It certainly implies a preference for monastic self-sufficiency in funding the architectural improvements over royal donations. Is Morven's tabula being deliberately vague? Julian Luxford suggests that the money raised in the 30 years after Edward's demise was the singular most remunerative Benedictine cult income he has come across. St. Peter's Abbey had many strong competitors for donations from the numerous large convents in the Severn Valley. It's just think there's the Holy Blood of Hales, two saint shrines at Worcester, abbeys at Malmesbury, Tewkesbury, Evesham, and countless others in Worcester and Gloucestershire. But without a saint of their own, was it the distinctiveness of royalty that made St. Peter's stand out from the crowd? Gloucester's medieval chronicler, from whom Morven gains most of his data, says that Edward III, the dead king's devoted son, came to the abbey many times after the funeral to attend his father's grave and to see what progress was being made in the building. It's very likely that his masons designed the Purbeck marble tomb chest, its soaring pinnacled freestone canopy, and the serene alabaster effigy. The new king gave a model ship to sit by the effigy on a bracket that still survives. That's the little platform here. The gold ship's just long gone. After praying to his father during a violent storm at sea, his son, the Black Prince, gave jewels and a reliquary of the True Cross. His sister Joanna, Queen of Scotland, donated a necklace set with a large ruby, and his wife Philippa of Hainault gave a large golden heart, all to adorn the tomb of Edward II. But apart from these votive offerings on the tomb, both the abbey and royal records make no mention of any royal financial contribution to the reconstruction of the building itself. Instead, the only written evidence in the chronicle claims that the convent, that's the monastery, assisted by the donations of the faithful, was the source of the funds needed for the building transformations in the middle years of the 14th century. Another common explanation triggering the origins of perpendicular architecture stresses its coincidence with the devastation consequent upon the Black Death, justifying its simplified, repetitive panels as a cost-cutting and labour-saving means of mass production. But as we're about to see, some of the perpendicular features at Gloucester predate the arrival of the plague in 1348. Indeed, the chronicle itself dates the new work by each abbot it was carried out under, and the following table gives their names, dates, which work is ascribed, and who the chronicle says paid for it. As already stated, there is no documentary evidence of royal patronage for the building. Yet most architectural historians see clues in the structures themselves, which indicate at least the hand and eye of the royal mason, Thomas of Canterbury, who died in 1536, in the introduction of perpendicular style to Gloucester's south transept, the first part of the works. However, amidst all this, we must bear in mind that labels such as decorated or perpendicular are classifications of the 19th century, rather than ones recognised by the monks or the masons themselves. The first constructions in perpendicular style are likely to have been in the Chapter House of St. Paul's in London and the Royal Chapel of St. Stephen's at Westminster, itself a reinvention of the Saint-Chapelle of Paris. But both these buildings were subsequently destroyed in fires. So we're left with Gloucester Abbey as the earliest surviving example of perpendicular in England, leading to the myth of its origin here. I'll just read you one example of this from 1883. Quote, "The architectural changes at Gloucester in the 14th and 15th centuries have an interest far wider than any of that of mere local history. They form an epoch in the history of architecture, and the explanation of them given by Professor Willis in 1860 formed an epoch in the study of that history. We now know that the perpendicular style was in use as early as 1330, In short, so far as we can speak of an architectural style being invented, we may safely say that the later variety of Gothic, which is distinctive of England, was invented at Gloucester Abbey, unquote. So that's how the kind of story has been perpetuated. Putting this aside, just what are the features of Perpendicular found at Gloucester which make its novel appearance in the West Country so distinctive? Well, if we look at the choir, there's an undoubted emphasis on the right angle, and especially in its vertical components. The side walls are divided into seven tiers of rectangles. You can see them going up the side there. Whilst the great east window rises to 8 in its centre. The response, which front appears dividing up each bay, that's the bits, these nice, thin, straight, uninterrupted strips of stone here, rise from the floor to the springing of the vault uninterrupted. But the feature which, for me, is the signature of this perpendicular style, are the small vertical mullions that cut through the pointed arches, which have lost their grip on Gothic architecture as the vertical line finally triumphs the curved. And it's these, see that little straight bits going, and another one just going up there, and another one going there. It's this kind of emphasis on the vertical that's willing to cut through the curved, arched, pointed Gothic lines that we are so familiar with. If we compare Gloucester's choir and presbytery with an example of the previous decorated phase of English Gothic with its emphasis on wall thickness, multiple moulded arches, wide rather than tall windows, filled with complex geometrical patterns in the tracery, a concentration on surface decoration, and its signature feature, the double curving OG arch, we can see that the perpendicular innovations at Gloucester are all about height, flatness, brightness, and a grid of repeating rectangles which generated a spectacular resting place for the king. And why was this important to Abbot more than some 200 years later? Well, I think his motive was to draw the public in and to restore the abbey back to favour with its current monarch. In addition to the poem, he did this by refashioning the ambulatory of the church as a memorial to English kingship. Along with the tomb of Edward II, the abbey was also the resting place of Robert Curthose, the eldest son of William the Conqueror, who was buried here in 1134. His surviving effigy, which used to sit in front of the high altar, was made in the 13th century, but the tomb chest on which it rests was a Tudor construction. And in the second decade of his abbacy, Morvan had a large historicising monument made to honour King Osric, the abbey's 7th century royal founder, complete with an effigy holding a large model of the building and located in the prime spot just to the north of the high altar. And to complete the programme, William Morvan built a large cage chantry chapel with a magnificent alabaster version of himself in full pontifical vestments adjacent to King Edward's tomb and opposite an effigy of Abbot Serlo, patron of the Norman building, whose personal graphic on the far side. Along with the Great East Window, commemorating the royal victory at the Battle of Crecy, the east end of St Peter's Abbey had become a manifestation of its 900-year association with English kings. Morvan's chance to show off his efforts came to fruition in 1535, when Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn stayed at Gloucester for 4 days. He is recorded taking the king around the ambulatory monuments and to show him the perpendicular splendour above the high altar on more than one occasion. But it was in 1540, after the abbey had been suppressed and Morvan was just dead, that his enduring achievement was accomplished. The building and all its contents were spared the destruction common after dissolution by conversion into a cathedral. It is only as a royal mausoleum that it escaped destruction, as there was no population or geographical need to create a new diocese here. There were the two adjacent cathedrals at Hereford and Worcester, just round the corner, that were perfectly suiting the locals' needs. But as Henry wrote in his own hand on the document refounding the new institution, and I quote, "Wherefore, considering the site of the said late monastery of St. Peter's of Gloucester, in which many famous monuments of our renowned ancestors, kings of England, are erected, it is a very fit and proper place for the erecting of an episcopal see," quote. In the survival of this great building, and its link with the origins of perpendicular architecture, perhaps the most important work of Morvan was done. And we might remember him too, in the words of his last stanza. This compendious extract compiled was new, 1,520, from the birth of our Saviour, Christ Jesus, by the Reverend Father of worthy memory, William Malvern, abbot of this monastery, whom God preserve in long life and prosperity, and after death him grant eternal felicity.